Hello, everyone. My name's Duncan Artis. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of Allan Gray. And welcome to another episode of the Allan Gray Podcast, something we've been trying to scale over time because we think it's a very good way to get some of our more deeper thoughts across to our clients. Today, we're lucky enough to have Grant Williams. Grant is the host of the Grant Williams Podcast and author, and we look forward to having a great discussion with him. Maybe, Grant, if we can start off a little bit of your background and history, because maybe not everyone knows you as well as we do, and just touching on some of the places you've lived and some of the countries and, you know, how that sort of shaped your life and maybe some of the big things that have made you who you are.
I started trading a few months before the 87 crash, and you'll remember that as well as I do. I mean, it was an epic day. I mean, it feels like it was a day, but to have a market fall by 22% in a day is a real wake-up call. I was trading the Japanese markets at the time. And they just went up every single day. This was the middle of that Japanese bull market. And the market just went up and up and up and up. And suddenly things just fell apart. And that was a very seminal experience for me. And it's definitely colored my attitude to risk ever since. I understand that you, as Chuck Prince said, if the music's playing, you have to dance. But when you realize that really extreme outcomes can happen, I think for me, it's been a really good thing. I think over the course of my career, it's definitely kept me out of some of the bubbles. So I've definitely dropped off of things early rather than run them to the final blow off tops of these things, because I just think, you know what, this is getting too risky for me here. But over and above that, I think, you know, this idea of some kind of catastrophic loss is the one thing that every investor has to avoid. So I think having that lesson brought home to me early was an important one for me. I spent several years in Japan.
You were born in the UK?
Born in the UK, yep.
And then what made you leave the UK?
I kind of found my way backwards into this job in the dealing room at Robert Fleming & Co. in the middle of the Japanese mania. Managed to inveigle my way into a role in the trading floor. And about 2 years later, I was just offered a chance to go and work in Japan. And I just said yes. I literally said, I'll be there next Wednesday. Didn't know what I was going to get paid, didn't know how it worked. I knew nothing, but I always thought this is a great opportunity. And if I don't like it, I can always go home. So I went to Japan at the age of 22. I spent the best part of 4 years there. A year of the final blow off of the bull market, and then 3 years of the Japanese bear market that went on for two decades after that, which was interesting. And then I kind of bounced around. I was in Hong Kong for a period of time, was in New York for a period of time, Singapore, Sydney, all in the banking industry, all in trading, mostly equities, but also convertible bonds. I started in the JGB market of all things when they actually traded back in the 80s.
Allan himself was a victim of the widow trade, where he was short the JGBs in the 90s. And we're sitting here in 2025 and you only would have made money about 2 years ago.
That's exactly right. But that just shows you how long these things can persist. You know, that old quote about the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent has been proved every day by that Japanese JGB trade. I've been very fortunate. I've worked mostly investment banks. I spent a time as a hedge fund manager working for a great friend of mine in Singapore. And then in 2014, we co-founded Real Vision, some friends of mine.
Where did that come from? Do you go, I'm quite a friendly chap. I think people will listen to what I say. And why would anyone want to come onto Real Vision?
Well, these are the questions we should have asked before we started it. We just had this idea, literally over dinner one night. And you know how you have ideas over dinner and you talk about them until 2 a.m. and they seem like the greatest ideas in the world. And then the next day, after the wine's worn off and you've kind of had a bit of a sleep, you just forget about them. And this is one of those ideas that just never went away. And we thought that over the course of our careers, Raoul and I, that we'd had hundreds of conversations with people over dinner, just peers in the industry with no agenda. But you always walk away from those tables, and you know this as well as I do, with something in your head, oh, that was really interesting. I've never really thought about that before. Or you've had your ideas challenged by somebody smarter than you. Something always comes at those conversations. So the idea was really simple. So why don't we film some of those conversations and let other people listen in? I mean, we didn't know how to make any videos, or we didn't know any of that stuff. It was an idea. We got very lucky finding the right people early on to hire to help us produce the actual content. And it just kind of took off because there wasn't anything like it at the time. Now there's a lot of video content out there, and we just allowed these conversations to develop. And when you have something like that where it's in very short supply and people find it, they tend to be very sticky and they go, well, this is what I've been looking for. I want this. It's not just another podcast that I'm going to subscribe to and then listen to a few and then find I've got 25 other podcasts. There's nothing really like this out there that's going to be an hour and a half of two people exchanging ideas. And it just kind of worked. And I did that for 4 or 5 years and then stepped away and stepped back to doing my own thing and added a video stream to the content I did, because I was really interested in not necessarily talking to people about markets per se, but talking about their careers and their experiences and the lessons they've learned and the failures they've bounced back from and the successes they've had. And when you ask someone about failure, when they've ultimately been successful, and all the people that I spoke to were successful, people are very happy to talk about their failures because that failure didn't define them and they learned something important from it. And that, to me, was much more valuable for people to listen to than us talking about where we think NVIDIA might be in a year's time, because that's a guess about the future. Whereas if you talk about experience in the past, that's knowledge. That's there's learnings, there's wisdom in that. And that's something you can watch again in 10 years' time and still take something from.
I mean, I obviously wasn't here because I started Allen Gray in 2001, but sort of seared into the firm's DNA is 97, 98, because that's when we had the South African bubble. South Africa was ahead of the world. We had our bubble before the NASDAQ. Banks trading on 4x NAV and Dimension Data, the big IT companies. And I think over the 2 years, we lost 60% of our clients. And to like get through that, yeah. You know, and being told you don't know what you're doing is reads through and it's like seared into the DNA of the firm.
Well, it's interesting. When I came into the building, I saw the quote on the
from
wall
Allen,
there.
Yeah.
That really resonated with me because this idea, particularly if you go through a period of losing 60% of your clients, a lot of people will think, well, what do we need to do to the culture of the firm to keep our clients, which is completely the wrong way to think about it. You have to stick to your principles. Clients are going to come and clients are going to go. You have to do the best thing you can for them every single day. And often clients act in their own worst interest because they have FOMO, they have all these kind of emotions going around, and that's why they outsource that job to people like you.
Yeah, it's one of the things we try to do at Allen Gray. So I think you know, Grant, well, we know the average fund manager underperforms the index, but the average client underperforms the average fund manager. Yeah. And we at Allen Gray got one of the lowest gaps there through things like the podcast, but it's the ultimate irony that you can't get alpha if everyone's rational.
Yeah.
I know the one thing of people who listen to your podcast would love to know, like how many frequent flyer miles do you have? Whenever you're there, you're in some other country.
Yeah.
Sure, could I have some?
Yeah, I've got plenty. My kids are the ones who normally steal them. I'm just shy of 1 million. I'll probably cross 1 million this year, I think.
You also have another podcast just before we get onto the investment stuff about sports. And I mentioned to you many people in the investment team. I actually get a smile on my face when I see it come up on the podcast feed because I know I'm going to have a fun hour listening to you and Roger. So where did the love of sports and music sort of come from? And maybe just your relationship with Fulham, because you mentioned it quite often.
I've always loved music since I was a little kid. I love music. And music has been a big part of my life, and especially traveling around the world. It's funny, I remember times in my life and places I lived through the music I listened to when I was in those places. So still, I'll hear a song and it'll take me back to Sydney in 2005 or Hong Kong in 2000 or Japan back in the early 90s. So I've always loved music, but sport, I was a sports mad kid, as every single person in South Africa seems to be, yep. Which is terrific. I played football, I played rugby. I didn't play cricket, found that a little bit too slow for me. I played basketball. Good friend of mine wanted to start a podcast. He's in the sports industry, Roger Mitchell. He was the one time a commissioner of the Scottish Premier League football. And he's now a consultant and does a lot of advisory work in the sports game. And he wanted to start a podcast and didn't have the first idea how to do it. So I said, well, I'll help you, show you how to do it. So we'll do a few together and then I'll take the training wheels off and away you go. And that was 7 years ago. And we've been doing them together ever since. They just, for me, they're just fun. For him, it's part of his business. And you know, there's a means to an end for Roger. But for me, I just love talking about sport with mates, and we disagree about most things, but it's fun. You know, they're a great source of joy for me.
Yeah, it's actually quite interesting because MultiChoice, which was the big pay TV, they've been bought out by Canal Plus now, and our clients are one of the biggest shareholders, and SuperSport, I think, is the best sports channel in the world, and obviously they're quite big sports buyers. As you know, you can watch more Premier League matches in South Africa than you can in England. When we're shareholders, I actually bought Roger's book and told them to read it because, okay. You know, they were always, Chris Becker always said, if you want to know why you have to pay R1,000 a month for premium DSTV, he said, go and look at Victoria Beckham's ears because that jewelry is paid for David. David's paid for the club. The club gets paid by Sky and we have to pay the rights for it,
right,
for it all to come down. Maybe, Grant, I thought the other thing was interesting about the change sort of in the media industry and why podcasts have taken off. And it is quite ironic that you think Joe Rogan was a mixed martial arts fighter. And if you go and look at all the interviews, he actually had hair. And he could almost swing the entire US election. So maybe you can just say why you think podcasts have taken off. And then also, why only, like, I think we said 5% of the podcasts have like 80% of the listenership. I can't remember the exact number, but there's just so many of them. And it's also some of the ones at the top are a bit strange to put it in.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, I wish I understood it better. I think, you know, there's a time and a place for a certain voice. And I think the Joe Rogans of the world will kind of have this parabolic arc where they'll be everywhere. And then inevitably they'll kind of tail off, because when you've listened to Joe Rogan, and I've listened to, you know, I now select the guests I want to hear.
Yes, yep.
I don't want to listen to Joe Rogan every week. I feel that's the way these things will go. But it's amazing, you know, in a smaller part of that podcast ecosystem, you can have a really, really connected, strong, sticky audience. And it may only be a couple of thousand people, but it's a proper audience.
The quality of the audience.
Yeah, and I think that's the most important thing. And it was interesting, you know, in the Real Vision days, when we began Real Vision, the idea, it was content focused. It was, let's just create the best content we can. Let's have the most interesting conversations we can, and let's see what happens with the audience. Maybe there isn't an audience for it, and we'll fold the tents and go home. We focused on having these in-depth conversations that you couldn't really hear anywhere else. And it worked, and it worked like a charm, and the audience was terrific and very engaged, and we were giving them exactly what they wanted. And as the company grew, then we hit the point where there was potentially another path to go down, which was, okay, let's now focus on the size of the audience. We've proven that we can get to 25,000 subscribers. Now we want to get to 100. And that is the moment where, if you decide to prioritize audience size, the content becomes secondary. And once the content becomes secondary, you've got, I think, a problem, because now you're not being true to what it was you set out to try and do. And if you want to start with the kind of audience we had, which is a very, say, a small but really thoughtful, really engaged audience that wanted to be challenged by ideas, that's a really tough audience to get, because they're very, very choosy about how they spend their time. If you want to say, right, we want to get four times that audience, by definition, you have to make the content shortable, more accessible. You know, the technical term will be dumb it down. I don't know that that's necessarily true, but you have to change it. And I think once you do that, once you let the audience become the goal, I think that's the first step down the wrong path. It's very difficult. It's really difficult.
On your show, you avoid having an echo chamber. When I look at my own media consumption habits, we were chatting about how trust in the media is at an all-time low. And I think that's why podcasts have taken off. I mean, I basically almost don't read any South African newspapers or things anymore. I have some podcasts I listen to. I subscribe to maybe 20 people on Substack because they can be independent. And we were chatting about Barry Weiss, how ironic it is.
Yep.
She leaves the New York Times and sells her business for $200 million to Paramount or Sky Dons. And now she's going to be the chief editor of CBS News. Like, your sort of thoughts on that? We spoke yesterday, like, just people don't seem to like trust what they read or hear anymore. And the problem is you can also get stuck. I worry a lot of South Africans get their news solely from CNN and Sky.
Yeah.
And that's one view of the world. And then something else happens and I go, how did that happen? And it's like, well, yes, because you were just in this echo chamber listening to what you want to hear.
Yeah, I think this idea of trust is so important. I think this idea of trust is foundational to the entire society that we've built. You know, it has to function on trust. And of course, trust, like everything else, ebbs and flows. And unfortunately, the more comfortable everybody gets, the more lax they get about who they trust and what they trust. And I think we're seeing this with media now. You know, people will have at the same time gone down a path of trusting everything the media says. And now we're seeing the fact that this kind of rebellion against traditional media, because that trust has been misplaced and it's been taken for granted. And I think people are starting to realize that we can't trust the media. And once trust breaks down, it's very difficult. It's not impossible, but it's very difficult to get it back. And I think the media is at that point in the cycle where trust has been lost. And it just so happens to have been lost at a time where there is this access to independent voices, Substack and podcasts and all that stuff. There are plenty of independent voices out there. And look, it's really hard to be truly independent. But at least you know with Substack or with podcasts, the views aren't corporate views. There's somebody's views, and most people are pretty clear about their views, and they're fairly consistent. If you listen to them or read them over time, you come to understand what their views are. And then it's down to us to say, okay, well, I really like this guy. I need to find someone who has a different opinion to him so I can read both of them. And it doubles the workload for us. But if you really want to understand what's going on, I think it's not something you can outsource. You know, it's incumbent upon us to do the work. If you really want to understand the world, don't wait for that understanding to come to you. You have to go out and seek it. And that's, it's onerous because you've got to wade through a lot of stuff, but there's some remarkable people out there who you can learn from. And I think this podcasting and Substack platform gives us all the chance to find them.
That's something I worry about a lot for when I see the younger analysts coming into the team. We're starting to hire people who weren't born when I started at Allen Gray, which is a bit concerning. But, you know, you sit on your phone, you watch TikTok, and you now, instead of writing the essay for yourself, you just put it into ChatGPT. And I don't know if you saw, there was that amazing statistic where they took people who wrote their essay or someone who put it to ChatGPT. The person who put it to ChatGPT can only recall 10% of the essay. That's why we encourage everyone in the investment team to read. Our common friend James does it. And I think we've got like 4,100 books in the library. And on our analyst portal, we have an interesting reading. So whenever someone reads something interesting or something, like, they post it there, and every month we kind of get a summary. Maybe, Grant, just to come to the markets, like these last 40 years, I call it the hyper-financialization of the world, where we kind of trade paper assets. Maybe just give us sort of a summary of sort of the one thing I have heard from some people that go like, oh, great, you're going to speak to Grant, but he's just going to tell you central banks are bad and you must buy gold. Like, why are you going to bother listening to him? Because there's the summary. You only need to watch TikTok for 2 minutes, because that's what Grant is going to say.
I get that. It's fair criticism. I've been an advocate of gold since 2003, which is when I first bought my first ounce of gold. But I've been consistent in that because I think it's been the solution to a set of problems that I could see manifesting over the next 20 years. And those problems have manifested pretty much the way I feared they might. And the performance of gold has been extraordinary as a means to defer some of the problems caused by those policies. Everywhere I go in the world, everywhere I talk to, they all have this feeling of change. They can't quite put their finger on it, but the world's changed. And whether it's the media or it's Gen Z or whether it's politics, whatever it may be, there's just this great feeling of angst around the fact that the world's changing. So, you know, we as human beings, we're not wired to deal with change very well. We like consistency. No matter what we say, and some people say, oh, I love change, you know, change is great, it's still unnerving when it's not change that you've decided to implement. If it's happening to you, it feels a little confronting. And so, you know, 2020 and COVID was the perfect place to put down a marker and say, look, this is where the world has changed. And that, I think a lot of people go back to COVID because their lives changed. It wasn't a feeling anymore. People weren't allowed out of their houses. People weren't allowed to see their relatives and go to funerals and weddings and this kind of stuff. So that was a change you could actually pinpoint and identify and characterize. So I took that as the kind of tent pole. And then I talked about the 40 years prior to that, so 1980 to 2020, and went through, you know, some of the big moving trends, demographic trends, and, you know, the China joining the WTO and global GDP and global population and declining death rates and central bank interest rates for over 40 years declining from 20% to zero in pretty much a straight line, you know, which has cumulative effects of people being able to borrow more and debt increasing and house prices going up. We all know what the world's been like. If the last 40 years were like that, and it really was an environment where it was remarkably straightforward, it's easy, but straightforward to make money. You just had to be invested and stay out the way and not second guess your decisions and not be swung around by, you know, bad days in the markets or trends, and you would have made an awful lot of money.
That includes the TMT bubble, the GFC,
absolutely,
and COVID.
If you'd stuck through all of them, you're still at the highs. You've made a lot of money, and you've had some scary months or maybe a couple of scary years here and there. But if you stayed the course, everything was a tailwind to you. And now things have changed. And if you just think about that, if you have 40 years of tailwinds and things have changed, you can start by saying, okay, we're not going to have 40 years of tailwinds. That's the change. So what does that look like? Does it mean we have 40 years of headwinds? Possibly not. But suddenly it becomes something you have to maybe think about. And I think when we're talking about investing capital, it's these ideas that you have to think about and not discount. We were talking with Adam, you know, this idea that they realized that there were suddenly a non-zero chance of a precipitous loss in a particular stock, the Taiwan Semiconductor. And so they had to change their allocation to that, not because they believed in the company any less, or they thought the company was any worse than they actually were, thought it was when they invested in it. But now there was a potentially catastrophic outcome on the table. So they readjusted the way they thought about it, the way they positioned it. And those are the kind of decisions that you have to make. And it may be that someone would say, for example, you know, it used to be a 0% chance of let's say, a civil war in America, 0% chance. And you've been absolutely right at saying it's a 0% chance for the last 100 years. Now, I don't know what the percentage is, but I don't think it's a slam dunk now to say 0% chance of some kind of internal conflicts in America. So just that simple statement, for the record, I'm not saying there's going to be a civil war in the United States, but I'm saying if it's gone from 0% to 0.5%, then there is a 0.5% chance of a catastrophic outcome for assets that you're investing in the United States. So that's not to say you divest yourself, but you sit through and think, okay, is there anything I need to do to maybe mitigate this potential catastrophic outcome? And just doing the thought process and putting it on your radar and knowing that that's something I have to keep an eye on. I have to keep, if the percentage goes from 0.01 to 2% or 5% or 10%, do I have a plan to deal with that? Because, you know, catastrophic and permanent loss of capital is the Achilles heel of every single investor.
I think the tough thing thinking about at the moment is when risks are high, you would hope asset prices are low.
You would hope.
Like if I'm saying risks out of valuations, because that's the easiest way to protect yourself is to buy cheap assets. Yeah. Just as South Africans grow, the one interesting thing we always find here is our Reserve Bank governor, we think is actually one of the best central bank governors in the world. He's not very popular because he's kept real rates high.
Yeah.
But it's brought the stability. But South Africans are used to inflation. And I'll never forget the first time I went to Australia, when we asked the South African management, they said the strange things were prices hadn't changed for like 6 years, and retailers in South Africa were just used to passing on prices. So we were just used to it in South Africa. And the last few years, I think for the developed world, it's been a big shock. Like they were used to inflation of 1% or 2%, and all of a sudden you go to 4%, South Africans go, we got it low. And then what people have got wrong, especially I've seen a lot of presentations, people go, oh, it's great, inflation's going down to 2%. It's like, yes, but cumulatively over the last few years, it's 30 or 40. And I think there are two things from that. One, that's involved lots of the politics. Now, forget about the way the world's dividing, sort of that inequality, and then the people are feeling inflation. And the second of all, forgotten his name, the guy who was at SocGen with—
Dylan Grice.
Yes, Dylan Grice. He wrote a thing once, and it was like, even if people don't understand economics, which most people don't, or financial markets, when you've printed a lot of money, somehow it feels wrong because you were talking about trust. I mean, money is the ultimate trust. This is a piece of paper. Do you think that's sort of directionally correct? What I'm saying is like inflation has caused a lot of things, which doesn't necessarily make the headlines, even though you see on the polls, like, what are you unhappy about? I mean, if you look at Biden, you know.
No, you're absolutely right. Inflation is always the thing that causes the most trouble because that's when governments get voted out. You know, if people can't afford to feed their kids, they want that problem taken care of, and they will blame the person who's in charge when at the time it happens. And we've seen that, you know, and I think this idea of inflation, in fact, I was talking to a gentleman, and it's fascinating to think about here in South Africa, the problems that a lot of these Western countries are facing, are political corruption and governments being thrown out left and right and inflation. You have been through these cycles multiple times here in South Africa. So you're right. The rest of the world is getting a taste of what you guys have learned to adapt to. And it's a big shock. And inflation is always, I think, the one thing that can upset everything. Because as I say, you know, a father's or mother's job is to provide for their kids, put a roof over their head and food in their bellies. And if you can't afford to do that anymore, it becomes an existential crisis for you. And we saw that back in the 1970s in the UK. We had a massive spike that led to the UK being bailed out by the IMF.
The thing, sorry, just to wrap up, that I got, the article you wrote was, there was actually nothing the government could do. I know that sounds strange. They were trapped. If you try to do the right thing, your own voters and your own party takes you out. Well, and then you keep going, and then it's just worse. And so,
but that's why the South African Reserve Bank governor is doing such a good job, because to your point, they're stubbornly keeping inflation high. You know, Paul Volcker did this in the late 70s, early 80s. Margaret Thatcher did this when she was elected in 1979. She said, these are my policies, and it's going to be pretty ugly, and you're probably not going to like me, but I've got 5 years, and I'm going to stick to this path, and then you can vote me out in 5 years. And the first 2 years was horrendous. And then things started to turn around. But having those leaders, whether they're central bank governors or prime ministers or presidents, whatever it may be, who are willing to stay the course on principle and not change their course because they want to be popular and they want to stay in power, it's very difficult today because power now, not just here in South Africa, but power in America is a source of tremendous personal wealth now. It didn't used to be that way, you know. It used to be that politicians were successful business people who, after they'd had a career and made a lot of money, decided to give something back and would go into policy to try and make the country better or try and fix things. Politics is a career now. And like any career, there's a ladder that you can climb, and along the way, the remuneration gets bigger and better. You know, people go to university now to study how to be a politician. They don't have real world experience. So looking at the leadership class around the world now, it's very difficult to see where the leaders are going to come from who will make a stand on principle and will take the flak that comes their way if times are hard for them. You know, Obama, when he was voted in 2008 in the middle of a financial crisis with a massive majority and an enormous backing from the citizens who voted for him, he had an opportunity to say, look, things need fixing. We've just had a financial crisis. The debt is out of control. It's going to be tough for a few years, but I'm going to fix this. I'm not going to do QE. The stock market's going to fall. Unemployment's going to rise. All the things that we know happen when you try and redress the balance, but stick with me and we're going to get through this. And he would have got buy-in with the mandate he had. He would have had the country behind him. And he was the one guy in the last 40 years post-Reagan who really had the mandate to say, right, I'm going to take us through hard times, this famous austerity, and we'll come out the other side. And what did he do? He didn't do that. He wanted to be popular. And so he became very popular. And by the end of his second term, people looked at his presidency very differently to how they'd looked going into it. And I think that's a real shame, because I think he had a chance to set America back on the right sustainable path.
Grant, maybe also speaking about America, my colleague Adam Carr, who's leads the investment team at Orbis, we very underweight the US. I mean, it's mainly on a valuation basis. But like almost everything I read now is it's the de-dollarization trade, it's the debasement trade, it's like you need to move capital elsewhere. And I very much understand the argument that if you just move NVIDIA's market cap across, you can buy whole countries, right? So it's got nothing on valuation. But one, I think it's gone too far in the short term the other way. So I would expect dollar strength and long bond yields to come down. But are you this sort of big believer that sort of the American exceptionalism has ended? It's interesting because no one defines what exceptionalism actually means, right? Yeah. And we were chatting like, where did Google come from? Where did Meta come from? Where have all the chips come from? You know, and then you look at the rest of the world. And I was using that example of the sort of engineer from SpaceX who went to Europe and quit because it takes 2 years to do something. It happens 3 months in the US. Do you think that, like, for you, is it just a valuation thing? Because when I look at it, sort of the big deficits, the mirror of that is obviously the capital accounts. So that means America effectively export their equities and bonds and import real goods. If it was going to change, and I think that's what they want to do, stand corrected, you can have your own view. Yep. I think Scott Bessent's actually quite a smart guy, but they knew it was going to be hard. Yep. Or do you more of the view it was going to happen anyway? These imbalances have to balance somehow, and it's not necessarily 100% clear how it all works out in the end.
The wheel turns, and America's had an extraordinary period of dominance in the world. And I think this idea of American exceptionalism is a really interesting one, because when we work in financial markets, we have an idea of American exceptionalism around freedom of company formation and rule of law and the ability to move fast and deregulate and produce these extraordinary companies. But I think to most people, particularly people who aren't thinking from a financial markets perspective, if you talk about American exceptionalism, it's an idea. It's based in a constitution-driven America that was a force for good in the world and that, you know, upheld the rule of law and didn't have corrupt politicians. And it was called the shining city on the hill, right, for a reason. And I think that's been tainted recently. And I'm not putting the blame at Donald Trump, as a lot of people do. I think he's a symptom rather than the cause. So I think this idea of American exceptionalism is a tricky one to kind of pin down. But I think America's standing in the world has changed. I think it's still the most dominant country in the world for sure. But I think there are far more people now that look at that as a potential threat rather than a safety blanket. I've talked about this a lot, but I go back to this seizure of Russian central bank assets when they invaded Ukraine.
But to be fair, it was also seized by Australia, Japan,
no, absolutely.
Europe.
But we know this. It was seized through the SWIFT system. Yes. So without America, it couldn't have happened. And the Australians could have kicked and screamed all they wanted. And let's say they did. The right thing to do, one would argue, is for America to say, look, these have to be inviolate. We cannot seize state assets. We can put sanctions on banking. There were so many tools at our disposal. The fact they did that so quickly and seemingly without so much thought really surprised me at the time. And I wrote about this at the time. I wrote a piece called The End of the Financial World as We Know It, because that move, I felt, was completely shifted everything. And it incentivized every central bank in the world to redeploy their reserves away from the dollars. Not completely, but you're now being incentivized to hold fewer dollars because the jeopardy of getting your assets confiscated needs to be minimized as much as possible. And we've seen that in gold. We've seen a lot of people, central banks buying gold by the ton ever since, and the charts bear this out. I think that was a fundamental mistake that the US made. And again, we come back to trust. It's a very difficult one to walk back from, because how do you say, well, we may have confiscated Russia's central bank assets because they went against our interests, but we would never do that to you. It's a big leap of faith with a national security imperative like foreign exchange reserves to take that on good faith anymore. I think as the wheel turns, America's had this period of dominance. It's reshoring, it's withdrawing. You know, Trump is becoming more isolationist. And into that vacuum is going to step someone else. Now, people will talk about China wants to replace America as a global hegemon. I don't believe that's true. I think they want to be a polar hegemon in Asia, and quite rightly so. You can understand why they feel that's their rightful place. So the world's in an incredible state of flux. Again, this change we talked about, and it could go any number of ways. But, you know, Churchill said, you can always rely on the Americans to do the right thing after they've tried everything else. And we may be going through that period of them trying everything else, and eventually they'll realize and come good. But for the time being, we're back to this idea of change and the world being very different to how it has been.
And it's exceptionally difficult for a country like South Africa. We all think we're important because of cricket and rugby, but we are very important
in cricket and rugby.
We're only 1% of world GDP.
Right.
We may have most of the platinum group medals, but we kind of stuck in this middle sort of thing where if you look at kind of the ANC, obviously they were supported by Russia during apartheid. And so, like, as I said, we're the apostrophe S in BRICS. I don't know how we got in there given the size of our economy, but you're caught between this dividing world, and it's pretty tough. I mean, my view is you need to be on the Western side, because guess what payment systems you use, guess what banks you use, who the custodians, and, you know, it's quite an interesting question.
That's all being recreated on the BRICS side. You know, they're putting these payment rails and these banking systems, and they're putting it all in place to at least provide an opportunity for you to choose, which you never really had before. And I think, you know, along with this wheel turning, the fact that you are such a resource-rich country, this idea of going from the virtual world to the virtuous world, and this idea of the fake to the real. You know, if we do go back to a period where real is important, South Africa is in a terrific position because of all the resources you have. And I think, you know, commodity countries are going to do extraordinarily well in this next part of the cycle, as we kind of repudiate fiat dollars and we repudiate fiat pounds and euros and all these other currencies that are purely fiat. And there's going to be a scramble, not for paper. As you said, hyperfinancialization was the last 40 years. The next 40 years is going to be, I think, the repudiation of that. And what is real? Instead of being able to print money out of thin air, we're seeing this with the rare earths. We're seeing that there is a fight going on over real, tangible assets. And there are very few countries on earth that have more of that than South Africa. So I think it's going to be a great period for South Africa this next 10, 15
actually
years.
Although, as you know, I don't feel as strongly as you and Adam do, but it was a very interesting announcement weeks ago. The sort of Chinese steel companies are going to start paying BHP in renminbi for iron ore. But because the market's so liquid, BHP is not going to be able to hedge it. So, like, they didn't get this renminbi, and what do you do with it for now?
These are the solutions that they will need to find going forward.
In your podcast, one thing I always enjoy, as I mentioned to you, is the end game. And that's really because for a long period of time, Alan Gray and Orbis were associated with Japan, because Alan was one of the original investors in Japan, and obviously started off Orbis having a zero weighting in Japan. When you just started working, and you can imagine what that must have felt like when it was 80% of the world index. It's the greatest argument against passive investing. You would have been long Japan, short the US, then short Japan, long Japan. Because that's the ultimate sort of thing. You know, some people say, oh, China's the next Japan because you've got the bad demographics. They obviously had a property bubble, but it's carried on forever in Japan. So just your thoughts. I mean, is there an end game?
I think we're give or take 50 episodes into this Endgame podcast now. It's been a fascinating journey with Flake, but maybe even more than that now. And our very first guest, Mike Green, the very first answer to the very first question he gave, he said, well, of course, you realize there isn't an endgame. We set the podcast up beautifully. I said, well, what are we doing here then? But he's right. You know, there isn't an endgame per se, but there is an end to this particular game. And then we move on to the next game. And that's the period we're in now. We're reaching the end of this game. And by that, I mean this particular financial system, the way it's the post-World War II, post-Bretton Woods, purely fiat, post-1971 global monetary system is reaching the end of its useful life because of the inevitable amount of debt that's built up when you have no tangible restraint on being able to print money and buy assets. And I think the big question now is, what's the transition from that to the next? We don't know what the next game looks like. I contend that at some point, gold will be reintroduced to the financial system, even if it's just temporarily as a stabilizer, because you're going to need something that you can peg currencies around, and it probably won't be able to be the dollar anymore. It won't be able to be the yuan. It won't be able to be the euro. You'll need some kind of financial asset that you can actually peg things around just to stabilize the system. And Japan has been at the vanguard of that the whole way through, because Japan was ahead of everybody else in the bubble. It was ahead with the burst. It was ahead with, you know, QE came out of Japan in the late 90s. They were ahead of the world there. And so everyone's looked at Japan as the kind of roadmap for everybody else. They've seen debt get up to 265% of GDP, which is remarkable given the previous thought constraints around how far you could go with that. But Japan is a very idiosyncratic country in terms of the way its bond market functions, and the holders of its bonds are largely domestic. One of the ideas was that, you know, they could come up with this perpetual zero or all the things and just wipe the debt out. Of course, there is enough of it in private hands that that would be a problem. But we saw in Russia in 98 that you can renege on foreign held overseas debt and keep your own people good. You know, there are all kinds of ways around this. The interesting thing has been Japan's efforts for 25 years to create inflation. You know, they've done everything they can to try and create inflation to give them a chance to inflate this debt away.
And now they've got it, and they don't like inflation.
And they don't like inflation, because to your point about prices being the same, you know, a hotel room in the hotel that we used to stay in when I worked in Japan, and our guys from overseas offices would come and stay right next to the office, the price for that room in yen was the same, I think, 30 years later. It literally hadn't moved in 30 years. Now, the exchange rate had moved, so it, for other people it changed, but in Japan, the price stayed exactly the same. And that kind of stability, for everybody outside Japan, to your earlier point, it's like, well, this is terrible. If you're inside Japan, and every time I would go back to Tokyo thinking, oh God, it's going to be like a, you know, post-apocalyptic war zone, everyone's going to be miserable. And Japan's functioning perfectly well. Prices are steady, people are happy. So of course, when they do get 2% inflation, that seems like a lot to them, because they've had nothing and bordering on deflation for such a long time. So Japan is an incredibly useful signpost. I don't think Japan is going to dictate exactly how other things are going to go, but it's going to be a fascinating thing to watch this next little period play out, where they are dealing with inflationary pressures, small though they may be. We're going to see what effect that has politically. We're going to see what effect it has on policymaking. And that's going to be another little signpost for us to take into how we try and figure out how Europe's going to go, how America's going to go, how China's going to go. But they're all going to be slightly different, I'm sure. So Japan is not going to be an actual blueprint that we can use, but it's going to give us some important clues, I think.
Last thing to finish off with, we wouldn't be trendy if we didn't mention AI.
Yeah.
It's almost like you want to ban the word. So there are obviously two things. There's the massive investment. We saw Meta's share price, I think, was down 12%, I stand corrected, because people were viewing the increased CapEx as a sign of confidence. So you don't often get industries that announce more CapEx and the share prices outperform the market, because people get worried about your spending. So there's the financial side, obviously the social side, but you said something interesting. You don't think it's going to be as smooth a ride as, oh, we're all going to work 2 days a week. Some robot's going to do all your work for you, and it's universal basic income. I'm in the same camp as you. That just seems too easy. I'm not talking about Skynet, you know, coming to take us over.
When you see these science fiction movies and you see these worlds where everybody's living in their own little apartment and they've got their robot and everything just seems to work, no one makes the film about how we get from here to there and what happens between here and that world. As you say, I don't think it works very simply that with the amount of debt we have, we can afford to pay universal basic income to everyone. Unemployment is going to go through the roof because robots are going to take our jobs. And that transition is going to go really, really smoothly. So every company can fire 50% of their employees, replace them with robots. The people who got fired are going to get a nice little paycheck from the government that's going to keep them equal to how they were when they were in employment. Isn't that great? I just don't see it. And wouldn't it be great if it happened? But to make that your base case is so dangerous and so foolhardy. I just think it's nonsensical. So I don't know where AI goes. There's a massive amount of overspending. We've seen this in 2000 with the dot-com. We saw how that ended. I'm sure AI is going to be a part of the future. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But I don't think it's going to be, you know, these large language models are going to be the thing that takes over. We're already seeing people moving back to small language models and people training data on their own, training models on their own data, because you don't need, if you're a call center in India that's answering problems with a washing machine company, you don't need the whole of Wikipedia in your large language model. You don't need to be a PhD scientist. You need to be trained on your customer calls and a very small subset of that. So, you know, already we're seeing that shift away from LLMs to SLMs. And I think that's what you're always going to see is these great ideas come along and then people rethink them and think, well, actually, this is a great idea. We don't need that. Let's go this way. Let's go that way. So what happens from AI to here? I don't know. I suspect there's going to be a bust in terms of malinvested capital. We've seen billions of dollars. Meta talking about investing $1 trillion in AI over the next 10 years or whatever it is. I forget what the numbers were. All of that money is not going to be spent well. There will be hundreds of billions of dollars that goes away like it did in 2000. And from the ashes of that, we will have fixed assets that can be picked up for pennies on the dollar and data centers that were over capacity that can be repurposed. We'll see what we always see when the cycle turns. We'll see malinvestment exposed. And then the real value of AI is going to start to emerge the same way the internet did. We saw all this happen in 2000. And I think we'll see it again because we are cyclical beings. We make the same mistakes over and over again, slightly different variations of them, but we learn, we repurpose and we retool. And I think that's what will happen with AI.
And I think it's one of the great ironies. The people who benefited from the 2000 IT boom CapEx were none other than Meta, Google, right, who built their businesses. And who's doing the CapEx cycle this time? It's
exactly
them.
Right. Yeah.
And it was the application providers who
exactly
actually
right.
made
but, the... But the difference this time around being, obviously, they've had access to unlimited, essentially free capital. So the malinvestment is way bigger this time simply because of the sheer amount of low interest rate debt that's floating around the world that people want to get a return on, so they're investing in something they think will bring a return, and of course, all of it won't.
Thanks for coming to Cape Town, Grant. We hope to see you again. So we just spoke today about how sort of the world is changing, sort of high inflation, and Grant's sort of idea that, and I think we sort of support this, that maybe what worked the last 40 years won't work the next 40 years. If you would like to get in touch, please send an email to info@allengray.co.za. Please subscribe to the podcast. I mean, you can do it on any of the platforms you normally listen to podcasts. Allen Gray is an authorized FSP. To view our terms and conditions, please visit allengray.co.za. Until next time, I'm Duncan Artis. The podcast was produced by Volume Podcasts.
Imagine if you could save time like you save money. A second here, a minute there. Type a little faster, walk a little faster. Or you could stop scrolling on the internet. Just think of all the hours you'll save. Now what if you could take all that time and invest it? Watch it grow. Until eventually, one day, you'd have so much time that you wouldn't know what to do with it all. But unfortunately, time doesn't work like that. It can't be stored or banked. And unlike money, you can't make it back. That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time to do whatever you want to do, even if it is scrolling on the internet. Allen Gray, long-term investing. Allen Gray is an authorized FSP.